The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Rosie Swash, and this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. Coming up in today's podcast, dubstep heavyweight Scream tells us about new album Outside the Box being leaked on the internet and getting LaRue to return the favour for his In For The Kill remix.
I was sick of being tagged, that was the main thing. I was getting bored of having to make a certain style of music and being, oh yeah, that's a Scream track.
There's The Dream, Martin's mix of Tiga and the Savvy Fab in Singles Club, and Mount Kimby talks to us about the shoegaze dubstep tag and their desire to make it as a live act.
I enjoy making the music so much, I want to kind of justify that with this extra level. We probably work harder on the live set than we do on actually writing the songs, to be honest.
Hello and welcome. Well, Alexis is away on his holes at the moment, so I'm taking the hot seat for a couple of weeks, if that's all right. Now, as you heard in the intro, it's a bit of a dubstep special today with Scream and Mount Kimby interviews. So joining me here, it's the First Lady of Dubstep Journalism. Oh, she's wincing. Emma Warren, how do you feel about that tag? It's in the script, I've got to say it.
I'm not really sure. I think there are other people who...
who would claim that.
Yeah, there are lots of people who've done their bit for documenting what's going on, that's for sure.
Oh, that's very modest of you. And also making his Music Weekly debut. It's a writer whose profile page describes him as someone who stays up late listening to boom boom music and reading about politics. It's Dan Hancocks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I completely forgot on that's what it said on my profile page. But
now yeah. It's committed forever to the to
absolutely.
The podcast.
Boom, boom music.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of that on this show, so that's pretty good. This week, Oliver Jones, a.k.a. Scream, released his second studio album, Outside the Box. It's a move away from the wobbles of the dance floor to a more mainstream sound and features collaboration with LaRue, Murs and Sam Frank. We'll be discussing the album shortly, but first let's hear how Emma got on when she met Scream in the dubstep mecca that is Croydon.
Welcome to the Guardian Music Weekly podcast.
Hello, everyone.
So how are you feeling about dubstep these days?
It's having its up and downs, but I think it's affected a lot of genres in a good way, where it's made people be a lot more creative and they've seen that there's so much versatility. And I think you notice that's rubbed off onto other genres, like the autonomic stuff, for example. Like, I'm not saying that's purely because of dubstep, but like the idea of it, the spaciousness and everything. And like you can hear it in the house, like, you know, it's really wobbly house now. And like everything seems to have wobbly in it. There's a lot of music stemming from it, which is really cool. Like the Ramadan Man and Apple Pip stuff. And yeah, like this new sort of weird garage. I don't know what it is. I don't know, what do they call it?
Different. Sometimes people call it future garage, post dubstep. There's a whole load of not very good names for it all.
I hate the tag future garage. It's horrible. It's got the sort of spring in its step of garage, but it's sanctum. It's more techno. It's more like broken techno, I think. That I'm starting.
Bro tech.
I don't think I'd be too happy about that one.
Now listening to this might change the way you think, like a DUI might change the way you drink. After listening to this, you may need to see a shrink. The tune is insane, we gon' take you to the brink. It all slows down, time gets lost, where the weak can't follow cause the grind's too soft. I'm off on my own shit, dressed like I'm homeless, style so free, can't nobody own it. And this is 8-bit attack shit, the speaker doing back.
Because the album is pretty broad, you know, there's hip-hop, there's soundtracky stuff, there's some 8-bit stuff on there as well.
The album's kind of just what I'd like to listen to. It was kind of boredom, stemming from boredom. I was sick of being tagged, that was the main thing. I was getting bored of having to make a certain style of music and being, oh yeah, that's a Scream track. Whereas now, I want people to just not hear it and go, that's a Scream track. I just want people to hear it.
I suppose one of the things that's different about the album than maybe some of the other stuff that you put out on the Screamism or Freeism compilations or some of the stuff that you just play in your sets is that you've brought other people in. So you've got vocalists. Can you tell us a bit about who you got on the album and why they were the right people for this record?
I got Murs from Living Legends, LA-based crew. It was I really always liked his stuff because it's like quite political. Like, it's not your average hip-hop lyrics, and it's he actually made something of the track. Like, the instrumental was called Attack of the 8-Bit Baby. I don't know where the hell that name come from. And he used it, and he got a chorus line out of the title. He didn't need to, he could have made written his own song over it. And I thought that was really cool. LaRue, she said she owed me a track. So she returned the favour for a DM for the Kill remix. But finally, which I'm really glad, is Nothing Like Him for the Kill, because I could have been stuck with that track forever. I still love that track. Like, it did a lot for me. I want to make songs now. I want to make music. There's after the In for the Kill mix and other things like the Caxons remix and the Bat for Lashes. Even though I've done the Bat for Lashes after all, but it's amazing how much further a track can go with vocals on.
I call me from the other room.
Okay, so obviously you've been releasing loads of 12s on, you know, your own label and with other people. And then there were the Screamism EPs as well as a way of putting out stuff kind of on a regular basis. But then you started doing Freeisms.
Yeah.
I know that the album was leaked and maybe like the Freeisms is just your way of saying, well, whatever. But first of all, can you just explain what the Freeisms are about for you, and then you can tell us about having your album leaked.
The Freeisms were like, I've got the thing, I've got a lot of music. Everyone knows I've got a lot of music. And I know a lot of it's not going to come out, and a lot of that stuff I give out, there was a lot of demand. I could have put it out on vinyl, but I don't really want to. I know people want the tracks, and it's like, I wouldn't, like, there's no point, they're just sitting on my hard drive, they're going stale. So if people want them, have them, do you know what I mean? Because I'm not going to sell them, I don't really want to make. The thing is, you don't really make any money off music in this day and age, really. It's about live performance. So it was just, and the whole idea was it was to keep up. It was to promote the album. Look, man, there's stuff to listen to. Just take that for a minute. Just wait for the album to come out. Because I'm not downloading it legally. It's just something that happens now. Leaking is a totally different thing. Like, once the album's out, you can't stop it. But when it gets leaked, it's such a horrible feeling, because you're doing all this to promo it up, leading up to the big day. And then once it gets leaked, it's just like gutting. People message me, I've downloaded it, but I still want to buy it. No, you're not. Like, I'm not bothered about it. I am bothered about the sales. I'm more bothered about the actual music that's coming out. Thousands of people are going to have it now. Someone sent me a link to where I could download it. It's like, to a Russian site. It's like the Russians, you can't do nothing to stop the Russians. There's no copyright law in Russia.
Like we said before, there's quite a broad range of stuff on the album. And one of the things that really comes through is that love of sort of energetic jump up jungle and hardcore and that. Yeah, rave. It's the power of rave. First of all, can you tell us about those tracks that kind of embody that for you on the record? And then also, I thought it might be interesting to ask you about what's your ultimate favourite old school jungle track?
Originally, that whole style of tune was... Yeah, it started with Burning Up that come out on Digital Soundboy. That, like, I can't play the tracks because, like, I have to kind of keep in range of what I produce, so... Burning Up, it was originally called a jungle tribute. Like, it was never a track to be released. It was just it's for me, and then it kind of caused a lot of hype, but then it stemmed on to listening to the records on my wall, which is based on my brother's record collection. I'm obsessed with the whole rave culture and the UK rave culture from the 90s, where it was, people didn't know the tunes because there weren't the internet. There was no, like, it was tapes that got passed around and you didn't know, you just went out and actually listened rather than now, because everyone knows every tune. You're going out to socialise now rather than going out to actually be a part of something. And I was just trying to bring the, like, sort of just the rave element back into music, trying to show people we can still dance without. And I keep coming back to the wobble, but it's like, that's what is, it's become dubstep obsessed, is the wobble. And I'm trying to show people we still dance, and trying to bring that rave element back, that warehouse vibe, just try and make people dance rather than just go and get really masculine. And I like girls dancing as well, do you know what I mean?
That was Scream there, talking with Emma in a beer garden in Croydon.
It certainly was, yeah. Correct? We nearly did it in a place called Milan Bar.
I thought you nearly did it in Wetherspoons.
Yeah, well, the Milan Bar is a Wetherspoons, so we nearly did it in Wetherspoons. then we went down the street to a bar called The Edge, which had a beer garden.
Oh, nice.
Before Scream went out on a boys' night out with his mates, including his mate Shandy. Okay. It's good. So actually, it was very kind of him to make some time before his night out with his mates to come and speak to us.
Scream was talking there about various collaborations, and he touched on the LaRue track on this album, which is called Finally, which I really like. do you like it on the album. But is it fair to say that his In For The Kill remix was a turning point as much for LaRue, or, you know, as much for either of them?
I'd say only in terms of him understanding the power of a vocal. So he's fully used to making hundreds or probably thousands of people go screamingly mental in a kind of dance floor environment, like fully understands that. He's done that thousands of times and he knows he can do that. But I think with that remix, he realised that it could go bigger than that. And I think he, you know, the impression I get from what he says is that he understood that he could touch so many more people, you know, because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's only a small amount of people that are really interested in music, you know, maybe 10% of the population care enough about it to actually want to go and actively engage with it. Whereas with a track, with a vocal on it, you can touch, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, a huge percentage of the population. And I think he feels now that he can do that. And that was the turning point rather than anything else.
He's worked with sort of vocalists and MCs before, but it's very much in that rave mould, isn't it, rather than writing a song. And that's sort of the challenge that most of the people we're looking at today face, is kind of making songs rather than tracks.
And that's exactly what he says in that interview that he strives for.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely, I do like the album and it's actually growing on me the more I listen to it. But immediately it feels like what he was calling the wobbles, the wobbly side of it. It feels really split down the middle between that kind of, I guess, quite masculine dubstep and then the vocal-led stuff, which I'm much more, you know, like unashamedly into that stuff.
Likewise, I mean.
Yeah.
It doesn't end up being a gender thing, although that kind of wobbly bass line is, I think, likely to fill up clubs with more guys. And that kind of image of, you know, a bloke with his T-shirt off and a ponytail. It's a sort of, it's a drum and bass kind of rave spirit, which is overly macho, which I think has suffused that side of dubstep.
Does the album work for you?
Yes, yeah, in fits and starts. I mean, I think I like it about as much as the first one, I think, which is to say it's still really difficult to make a good dubstep album. It's just not necessarily an album genre for me. But when it really hits very well. And his sort of, the fact that he's explored a bit of his, you know, rave history, his Big Brother's record collection and so forth, really comes through and comes through well.
The thing is, I don't think we should hate on the wobble too much, because the wobble, even though it's become much maligned, actually had a really important role to play in the very beginning, because it was that power, that sheer power of it all, was what made it so kind of visceral and exciting for a lot of people. And obviously a genre's got to evolve. And I think what's happened with that side of it is people have taken one element of it and then just kind of stuck with that rather than doing what everyone else has done and actually make it more interesting. So, you know, the wobble, you know, you don't want to keep on doing the same thing over and over again, but it did have a really important part to play
and could
you know, and was a very powerful thing to experience. I think the thing that's interesting about this is people say, you know, I think one of the things people have been saying about this record is it's a bit inconsistent, it's a bit hands in the air, housey and trancey and all that sort of stuff. I don't really care. I think it really works as a kind of pop record. Mm. But I also think what's funny is that often people that made that kind of hand-in-the-air, housey, trancey records were just making those records, and they were making them to make money because they knew they could make money from it. So it's not like they were making really mad alien records on the side. Or they kind of started off making alien records and then they kind of divorced themselves from it and made pop records. Whereas he's still making really amazingly alien, bizarre, brilliant dance floor tracks and is perfectly happy making essentially what's quite mainstream music and yet still continuing to be, as you know, very really avant-garde.
Last week we had on Singles Club, we reviewed the KTB On A Mission track, and we talked about dubstep's strive for the mainstream, and the mantra of the last few years has been, vocal led dubstep is what's going to do it, and you feel like something like KTB's got that written all over it. Do you think that as far as any kind of mainstream success goes, it's kind of just scream and banger, or is it something that you feel throughout the rest of the scene?
I think there are two things, actually. I think, first of all, I think the influence is just, it's a bit broader than that. I don't think it's necessarily about individuals kind of popping through. I don't really think anyone's pushing it to the mainstream. I think it's just happening. And it's happening because there was so much energy in that kind of initial sort of creative explosion and whatever you want to call it. So I think it's just happening and people are running with it because they want to. I don't think it's not because they need the money. I mean, these people earn huge amounts of money DJing. You know, they're like possibly some of the most successful DJs in the world. So it's really not necessarily about wanting to make money. I think it's just a sense of being able to reach loads and loads of people that lots of people are kind of exploring and being very, very happy to do. There are individuals that will probably pop through and end up being kind of known to the mainstream. But I think more than that, it's the influence kind of around and about. What's been great is that other genres of music have had to sort of step up, you know, house, techno, grime. Even that kind of like LA brain feeder type music is having to step up because suddenly there's a form of dance music, electronic music, street music that's had massive international appeal. Mm. So everyone else has had to kind of step up and do something kind of exciting and rejuvenated. And they've also benefited from the kind of cross-fertilization of all different artists kind of popping into different areas and making music that maybe not, you know, sort of quote unquote part of. Mm. And I think that just means it's a really creative time for dance music in its broadest sense. And as far as I'm concerned, as a dance music aficionado, that's a really great thing. I'm very happy about it.
Well, the Outside the Box by Scream is out now on Temper. Let's move away from dubstep for a wee while and onto Singles Club. I've got a few treats in store today. And first up, it's Dan Hancock's choice. I wanna be your all you ever talk about. Baby, and if you let me in that body, I'ma turn that motherfucker out. Baby, don't make me watch if I can't ride it. And I didn't get your name, lil' mama, but I decided every time I mention you, I'll say you're my heart. That was Yamaha by The Dream. Dan, talk us through. First of all, what does he mean, Yamaha? What does it mean?
What does it mean? Yeah. He's been riding one, and it's a sort of cipher for a love song, as pretty much everything that he ever does or says or sings, you know, is.
He does like his weird metaphors.
He does, and he likes his women a lot. The Dream is someone who I will happily use the word genius about continually. He's responsible for Single Ladies and Umbrella, which is, you know, already makes him arguably the most important person in pop in the last 10 years. And his own material is fantastic. It doesn't get the attention it deserves, except from, bloggers, DJs and producers, from what I can make out, who all completely obsess over him, and I join them in that. He's a sensational artist. It's kind of... That one song is enough to make me want to learn to drive for the first time in my 29 years. Perhaps not a moment too soon, but just to have the top down and be sort of steaming along the motorway.
And you yourself said it's very Prince-esque.
Very Prince-esque. Yeah,
which is no bad thing.
No, absolutely not. I mean, Prince at his prime, I think, you know, really.
Yeah, sort not of like
1987.
The last album.
No, exactly. Not the kind of thing you give away free with the newspaper.
I do really like The Dream. I'm slightly fascinated by him, and I find his albums are. I find he can be almost a little bit trippy. That he's quite weird. His lyrics can be quite weird, and what I find quite strange about. I mean, you don't get it on a song basis, but throughout an album, he'll go from that real, like, loads of sexual metaphors, really, really weird ones. And, you know, as you said yourself, really loves the ladies. And obviously, they, you know, has some conflicting feelings about them. And so you get a sort of bravado with him. And then suddenly he can't keep up the front anymore. And he's just got to wear his heart on his sleeve. And it's just really, like, emotionally all over the place. And it actually is very rare with male, I don't know what you call it, you know, R&B or anyone in that kind of canon. It's actually still quite rare to have men being that weirdly sincere.
Yeah, a bisexual friend of mine has actually, she described him as too gay for her.
Which, he's not actually gay.
He's not, no.
Okay. In sentiment.
In sentiment, gay, in sentiment, yeah.
Emma, are you a fan of this track?
He's obviously really talented and has been really influential, and I really like the record as well. But what I like about it most is a sense of having a male soul singer doing something which feels very contemporary. Mm. With most, you feel like it's much easier for male soul singers to do stuff that's quite retro, like Aloe Black, for example, than do stuff that feels very kind of modern and contemporary. And for them to be doing that, you know, the thing that the really good male sort of R&B and soul singers, you know, your D'Angelo's or Ryan, what's his name, who did...
Ryan Leslie.
Ryan, of course, yeah. You know, Ryan Leslie or John Legend.
Brilliant.
I mean, Ryan Leslie, lovely. Oh. You know, I mean, those are the kind of people you really crave to hear more of. Yeah. So, I mean, what I hope, I guess, is that, you know, more guys are going to be inspired to kind of make really amazing kind of male, masculine soul records. Mm. But I have to say, the Prince album's not that bad.
Oh, well, there you go.
Duly noted.
In my humble opinion.
Yamaha by The Dream can be found on the album Love King, which is out now on Def Jam. And let's have a listen to my choice. Don't care about friends of mine. Don't care about a good That's Let's Get Out of Here by Le Savvy Fav, and it's my choice. I have definitely talked about Le Savvy Fav a lot on the podcast before, but since they haven't had an album out since 2007, I think you can kind of get away with it in 2010. I didn't even know until like a week ago that they had a new album coming out, and it's already been leaked, which, as we can tell by Scream, is not something that bands like. I think what I like about this song is what I've always... It kind of crystallises what I really like about Le Savvy Fav, which is they're part of... You know, in fact, they were at the forefront of this kind of post-hardcore, you know, New York art punk world, which the music that can come out of that world, the kind of Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the Liars and that kind of music, can for me sometimes feel a little arch and a bit hard to connect with emotionally. And a lot of the attention that the Savvy Fav get for their live shows, and Tim Harrington, their lead singer, is like, you know, he's like this big bear of a man and his bizarre antics and on stage, and that gets a lot of attention. Actually, what doesn't get a lot of attention is that part of the reason I think they're so well liked is that the lyrics can be quite abstract, and yet they're always capable of I just find them really easy to connect with emotionally. I find them quite a sort of, there's a real sensitivity to their songwriting and an accessibility about what they do. And you know, in this song, you kind of hear them say, "Let's get out of here," over and over again, and it feels like a kind of overdone refrain in music, but there's just something really believable about it when they do it. So that's why I've chosen it. Dan, you're nodding. Maybe you like it.
I like it well enough. It didn't quite kind of it sort of it outstripped the sort of competition, which for me exists about 8 or 9 years ago. It's interesting you mentioned post-hardcore. The main band that came to my mind was one that I'd forgotten had ever existed. Sparta, who are one of the bands that formed out of At the Drive-In. One half of them went off and did noodly, weird, interesting stuff as the Mars Volta, and then the slightly more plodding, prosaic kind of We Are Rockers went and formed Sparta. And yeah, I have a confession to make about Le Savvy Fav, which is that I own a pin badge with Le Savvy Fav on, and I don't own a single one of their albums, nor have I even illegally downloaded
any of them.
Are you a badge collector? Not really, no. I don't really know how that happened, but it was actually it was a gig of theirs, I guess, about 6 or 7 years ago that I picked up. And you're right, I mean, they are sensational live. It didn't drive me to go and... this hasn't driven me to want to check out the album enough.
Quite. But you're going to wear that badge?
I will continue to wear that badge.
What does the badge have on it?
It simply has the words Le Savvy Fav. Nothing more exciting than that, I'm afraid. But, I mean, are they... Would it be fair, I'll ask you as the expert, are they sort of the kind of hipster rock band that are maybe a bit more to be seen rather than heard? Is that
Maybe. I mean, yeah, that's definitely the feeling that you get in the reviews, is that, oh, don't miss them live. And don't miss them. They are fantastic live, but I guess... as someone who does really like their, you know, I get it, they are hit and miss with me. About half of their output I'm really into, and the other half I'm not that into at all. But I guess I have always found them easy to like. I want to listen to their records much more so than I really want to see them live. And I've seen them live enough times, like, I don't know what I'm going to get. Right. Like, oh yeah, Tim Harrington's, you know, pretending to have anal sex with that man in the crowd, and now he's swinging from a rope from the ceiling. You know, you've seen it before.
It must be Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly. Emma, what do you think?
I thought it was like a really nice, bouncy, energetic, kind of euphoric end of nighter for a kind of messy indie disco. But the thing I like best about them is I feel like there's something about the word, their name, which, if you like had synesthesia, would be really incredibly pleasing to say. It's sort of like all limey and pointy, and you know, you could get a bit addicted to even saying it. I think it's like all the S's and V's, and I don't know.
It looks good on a badge, Emma.
Yeah, amazing.
But if you were from New York, or if you're in the band itself, you say Le Savvy Fav.
Oh, that's less pleasant.
Yeah. So you've got to be English for it to work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the liminess, literally.
Maybe not so many thumbs up for that one. That's Let's Get Out of Here by Le Savvy Fav. It is a free download online, and you can get the details from the band's MySpace page. Now it's time for Emma's track.
We'll be right back.
was the Martin mix of Tiga's Gentle Giant. Emma, tell us why you have brought it in.
I brought it in for a couple of reasons. One of them is because I'm a real sucker for that kind of like slightly euphoric, slightly religious sounding kind of steel drums. They make me sound like church should have sounded, but definitely not the sort of music they were playing at the Holy Innocents in Orpington when I was growing up. Which is a shame, because if maybe they had, I might have carried on playing. Sorry for the feeling. So yeah, there's that. Also, I think this reminded me of how sometimes a remix can take you back to an artist that you didn't think you liked so much and realise actually you do quite like them, because the original of this is also really, really good. Tiga's often more interesting for kind of the way he presents himself than the music that he makes, in my opinion anyway. Although obviously at the very beginning he did do, you know, some really interesting music. Anyway, so I really like that, but also I just think Martin's a really fantastic artist, and sometimes when we're thinking about music that's come from this whole, I know, sorry to bang on about dubstep, but it's easy just to think about the new people that are coming through, but there are people who now seem a little bit old school, like Martin, who's been around for the last 3 or 4 years, who are still making incredible music.
I do like this. I mean, you talked about the original, which was on Tiga's last album, which was out last year, 2009. Mm. And it was the standout track for me on the album, because for me, and it was also written, it was James Murphy and Jake Shears from Scissor Sisters, which is a kind of an unusual combination. But I think the original for me captured the thing about Tiga that I have always quite liked, which is the kind of slightly lascivious, opulent 80s feel to his music, and then combined it with what James Murphy does really well, which is bring a great deal of sentiment to a track, and the lyrics sound brilliant. And I think in this remix, I do like it, but actually knowing the original and it being one of the tracks on the album that I really fell for, whereas actually the Tiga album as a whole didn't grab me, was that it kind of loses the romance, I think, a little bit of the original.
I'm a complete sucker for this kind of, as Emma puts it, sort of church sound, of sort of big kind of empty kind of wash of kind of garage kind of drums and sort of, it's very, very sort of popular in Martin's sort of house sets as well, which is, I mean, increasingly what he's playing. He's Dutch, I should add, at this point. He's one of these people who kind of exists outside of what is normally a very closed kind of world of kind of UK dance music, which may reach out sort of to foreign shores, but only let people in who really know what they're doing. And Martin's one of those people. From, as Emma says, from many years ago, he's sort of had strong contacts in the sort of London scene. I like it a lot. I don't know the original that well. I have dim recollections of the Tiga album and was not really struck by it. So for me, anything that's kind of Martinized, and to me, it you know, that is quite recognisably his sound, is a bonus, and is I think more Tiga tracks could probably benefit from this sort of layering.
The Martin mix of Tiga's Gentle Giant is out on Monday. Remember, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly is a place for you to leave feedback for us. And here are some posts from last week's show. On Caribou being interested in maths, Barry Beatmaster writes, "Actually, it doesn't really surprise me that a purveyor of typically unfunky geektronica would be a mathematician." Brilliant as always, Barry. Thanks for that. George Delator chips in, "I love vacuum-sealed geek math electronica. Orteca and Ryoji Ikeda are my musical heroes. So after reading an interview with Dan Snave, where he said how abstract and mathematical his music was, I immediately bought his last album. I was so disappointed. It's just jumbly indie rock. It's got nothing to do with real geek electronica like Aphex Twin or Square Pusher."
Fantastic. That's
it's not geeky enough for this guy.
Wow.
Georgie Borgie has a few more general comments. "Glad the podcast is back. I really, really missed it when it was gone. I do have some issues. Why does the Singles Club always involve some pop or urban tracks? I don't understand what's wrong with either of those things. How come there was no mention of Bombay Bicycle Club's new album? And why is everyone over 30 on the podcast? Surely you can have somebody who was still at school when Beta Band were releasing their albums. P.S. If Rosie Swash is under 30, then please forgive me for my assertion." Are you putting your hand up because you're under 30, Dan?
Oh, well, yes. Also, I was at school when the Beta Band's three
too.
EPs came out.
Yeah. Me too. Well, this, we should
say
only
that, over 30.
Sorry.
I should say that Georgie Borgie's avatar on commenting is one of the three EPs
right.
artwork. So, but I love Beta Band, as any regular listener of the podcast will know. I am under 30 and I was at school when Beta Band came out, but on no circumstances are we having any Bombay Bicycle Club on the show. I'm sorry. So thanks as ever for all your feedback. Keep it coming, please. Next, we return to the world of dubstep, or post-dubstep, as our next interviewees, Mount Kimby, are generally called. Last year saw their first EPs, Sketch on Glass and Maybes, released on Hot Flush Records to roaring approval, and their debut album, Crooks and Lovers, has recently been released on the same label. Producer Pete spoke to members Dominic Maker and Kai Campos about the album, but first he asked if they thought Alexis Petridis' assertion that they sounded like shoegaze dubstep was accurate.
Well, yeah, I heard it said before. Yeah, we're both definitely love indie music, but the shoegazing thing was like something that I didn't really, not really like I've ever listened to that drawn out kind of shoegazy music before. And but I think it has had an influence. It's just that you don't really realise it until, and maybe you know you don't buy the album, but you hear it, and it's those kind of things that actually have quite a strong influence on you sometimes. Mm.
Every review I've ever read of your music, probably half of it has been dedicated to discussing whether you're post-dubstep or not. Mm-hmm. I guess there's two questions. Would you describe yourself as post-dubstep, and does it get a bit annoying to read that with every review?
I don't know. I mean, I've tried to not really read reviews, to be honest. People seem to be obsessed with, you know, really trying to classify what we do. And, I mean, we really don't care about it that much, like, in terms of genre classification. But I don't know. I mean, I suppose that could you could label it as that. It's personal preference, really.
We don't really have a problem with it. It's a necessary evil, and it's like this post dubstep. I mean, I don't even know what it means, really.
Do you have a dubstep background?
Yeah, we both got together to make dubstep, really, and it was the driving force of something that we both were interested in. Like when we first met in 2006 in London, and it was kind of all that we wanted to go out and listen to. So. Yeah, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing today if dubstep hadn't happened, exactly. So it's had a very strong influence, and maybe not, it's not maybe so obvious when you listen to the music, but it's there.
I'd read somewhere that you recorded the album live. Half true.
Yeah. We've been like, playing live a lot this year. It's been it's been very different. It's a completely separate art to sitting in a room and producing music. So we've been learning a lot, and as we're trying to figure out how to play songs that we've written on a computer live, you end up kind of just playing through ideas, and then new ideas come about whilst you're sitting there kind of fucking about, almost in a more kind of traditional band structure. And so the album had more of that than the previous two records. We're still not kind of going into a studio and playing everything in one go and then going back and doing overdubs and stuff like that. It's very kind of controlled.
Is that something that's important to you, to be able to play live?
Yeah, I mean, I always liked being on stage, not necessarily in the spotlight, but playing things live, and I just think it opens up a whole new enjoyment factor of, you know, being involved in electronic music. For me, it feels like I enjoy making the music so much that I want to kind of justify that with this extra level of, you know, actually having to work hard. We probably work harder on the live set than we do on actually writing the songs, to be honest. And just being involved in that continual process of getting better and better and better, and we've had to learn very quickly. And it's just been exciting to kind of try out new ways of doing things, really.
You're playing quite a few festivals this summer. Do you worry about being an electronic act performing in front of predominantly, say, an indie rock crowd, how you come across in terms of the spectacle? Mm-hmm. You know, not many dance acts have been able to sort of cross that boundary.
Uh-huh. It's definitely a challenge, and one that we're learning about and trying to kind of implement things that we're learning. But yeah, I mean, if we go and play in a club, people get annoyed because we're pulling out a guitar, and they're like, you know, I don't want to see that. So then and we go and play, you know, in like, you know, with the XX, and people are annoyed because we're playing kind of techno loops. So
you can't win, really.
Yeah, it's great because we get to play so many different types of gigs and in all these different kind of venues. And one day we're playing in a library, and then another time we're playing in Berghain, you know, the day after. So, but yeah, it's very obviously a lot of pitfalls, and the whole kind of performance element of the show is something that we're kind of getting more interested in. It's not something that we both do naturally, you know. Well, certainly didn't get into music to kind of because of the performance or about kind of showing off ourselves. And it's something that we're learning about and kind of trying to improve. So we'll see how it is at the end of the summer.
Your music is, to me, a lot more positive and less dark than other acts who come from a similar post-dubstep, we call it that, genre. Is that something you're conscious of? Do you think you're just positive, happy people?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, neither of us are ecstatic all the time, but I mean, it's just the way it came out, really. And I think we were enjoying the situation we were in at the time, you know, with traveling and stuff. We were still playing gigs at the time of writing. I don't know. I think we'd both settled down a lot more to the positions we were in when we wrote the first two EPs. We'd both sort of got a place where we can live, you know, like constantly. And personal situations are a lot more settled, so I guess maybe that might have had a...
But it's funny, because a lot of people kind of say that it's very kind of... Well, not the album so much, but just the music in general is very melancholy, and like, I see rain and stuff like that. So, I mean, like, we were quite keen on, in terms of the artwork, for it to be something quite bright and kind of overly lit, just because, yeah, we don't see it as being kind of melancholic or kind of happy. So it's like, yeah, hopefully... It represents a whole range of emotions. That's the aim, anyway.
That was Mount Kimby talking with producer Pete. I think it might be the first time we've heard producer Pete's voice on this podcast. Oh, yeah, Matthew Herbert, of course. So pretty much, Mount Kimby, pretty much at the other end of the spectrum from what we were talking about with the Scream album. Dan, are you a fan of the Mount Kimby album?
I am, yeah. I'm a big fan of it, actually. It's got layers. It's got a number of different dimensions. I've been reviewing the Mogwai live album and the Magnetic Man album today. And at listening to Mount Kimby after that, I was at times not clear which it was closer to. Right. You know, I mean, they obviously know how to use guitars to make kind of abstract instrumental music in a way that's affecting and emotional and good for them, frankly. As long as we don't have to call it post-dubstep, I'm happy.
Do you just review by alphabet? Are you just doing M today?
Yeah. That's exactly how it works, yeah.
One of the things that they do, with Mount Kimby do, which I particularly like in this instance, is field recordings, and not in the, you know, going to, you know, not in the anthropological sense that we might have come to get used to, but that I think it works for them, because it's funny that Pete was saying in that interview that there is a real warmth to patches of this album, and that it feels positive, because I actually think, whether it be something as simple as the lack of obvious vocals on this album, that there's actually something a little bit lonely about it. And I think it's very tangential and unusual in places, but always pulls it together at just the point where you think, no, this album's about to lose me. But I think that the field recordings, because the emphasis feels like it's on the ambience so much, actually that gives it a real human feeling. Emma, what do you think?
I think it's a beautifully put together album, actually. I mean, I think Burial's made probably the best electronic record of the last 10 years. And this isn't as good as that, but it's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
It's just really lovely to listen to. And you're right, actually, about this thing about it not losing you. The tracks are short enough. You know, it's like, what's it, 36 minutes in total? Nothing's over like 4.5 minutes. Some of the tracks are just 1.5 minutes. And you kind of get this sort of snippet of something, and then it moves on and you're somewhere else. I think the field recordings is a really good story to add on to it, and it gives you an extra sense of something happening in it. I think it probably does come through in the ambience. Actually, when you were saying that, I was thinking it's more of a story than actually something that comes through when you hear it. But it does have a sense of kind of travelling somewhere and being around and them having pulled in sort of something very unique about what they see and hear in the world, and then compressing it into a very, very cleverly and classily put together record.
I think it's quite nostalgic at points, actually, and that it certainly shares with Burial's music. It has this sort of sense of longing for a kind of quite garage influenced past, I think, with the kind of sound washes that are overlaid there.
Because I've seen them live a few times, and I think they do have more in common. I mean, actually, they might not like the word shoegaze, but sort of in that world of sort of shoegaze or drone or music like the Austrian artist Fenez, which is very, very beautiful and kind of feels quite sunlit, but is very ambient. I think they are actually very much in that sonic world, even if they don't think they are, in terms of the way they build their sounds and the kind of length, the way they draw sounds out and let that do the work rather than kind of dropping you in and out of sounds. Mm.
The lack of obvious drops on this album, which Christian Bennett, who works on the video team at The Guardian, is all about the drop, isn't he, Pete? But Mount Kimby are not. Crooks and Lovers, the debut album by Mount Kimby, is out now on Hot Flush. That's your lot for this week. Thank you very much for coming in, Emma. I hope to see you back in the pod very soon.
My pleasure, I'd love to.
And it's nice to see you, Dan. Did you have an okay experience, or will you be happy with an invitation to return?
I'd be very happy, yes. You've used me in general, thank you.
Thanks to producer Pete. As always, I'm Rosie Swash, and I'll catch you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.